Well, thank you so much, John. That was a very kind introduction. And thank you all for being here tonight. I'm very happy to see you. Not very happy of being on the stage, I must confess, but very happy to see you all. How many of you would say have a spiritual practice or are familiar with a spiritual practice? Okay. Good. So as John said, the talk of tonight was entitled In Search of a Genuine Spiritual Practice. Spiritual practice, sometimes those two words together may sound like a contradiction in terms. Can we really practice being more spiritual? So how does that work? Recently, a friend of mine who lives in California sent me, actually posted a video on my Facebook page, a very funny video. It's actually a parody of those of us who are in a spiritual search or in spiritual practice. And so this person in the video talks about being ultra spiritual and what that means, you know, to be ultra spiritual. And the first advice he gives is practice competitive spirituality. So, of course, it is absurd. So, from a certain angle, we can say, what do we mean by spiritual practice? And what I mean in this case is to cultivate certain habits, a certain way of living that may remove the obstacles that don't allow our true nature, our spiritual nature, to shine through. In a way, from a certain point of view, we can say we are already spiritual. So it's not something we need to create. It's something that it is already present there. But we do have to recognize that we still have many times several obstacles to put aside. So it's like a light shining through a little opening, and we make that opening a little bigger and bigger and bigger, and let that light shine stronger and stronger. I like the word genuine because of, you know, it means something that is authentic, something that is honest, something that is real, and that is actually happening. So we're in search of a practice that we're actually going to do. It's not only in our imagination, or it's not only just in our minds. If we take a look at our current society, we're going to see that the world is almost absurdly overloaded with information. Internet is one of the greatest tools that has ever been invented, in my opinion, but has also created a tremendous amount of information available for all of us, which has its positive sides and its negative sides. I recently found out that a blog is being born every half a second. So every second, there is two blogs being created. So count the amount of information that is. Just talking about blogs only. So think about websites and articles and news and books. And also the technology that has allowed, clicking three times and getting a book at home through Amazon, the magic of Amazon. So we have a lot of information available, and that sometimes plays against us, unfortunately. I remember once my brother telling me the story of something he read in an article, the story of this lady who grew up in a very small town that didn't really have a lot of access to information and books. And she grew up with only one book for many, many years. And this book was nature related. So it was, in that topic. But imagine how well she knew that book. How many times She looked into the images. She looked into every corner and every word, and really drank all that information and contemplated that so much. Nowadays is quite the opposite. We have sometimes dozens of books at home we haven't even opened yet. And what's worse, this culture of looking into the internet has developed in us this ability to scan very quickly and not go in depth into anything. So it's like a lot of information, but very fragmented. So this way of looking at things, I think, has created a mind that is both sometimes frantic and sometimes dull. Like, I'm sure that you have found yourself like looking into a Facebook page, for example, when you don't have any energy at all, and you just scroll down and look at it, just doing nothing, just letting the mind get really dull. And at the same time, looking for all this information that makes your mind get in a certain speed, really fast, and this scanning that has made us a little bit superficial and not going in depth into anything in particular. So that's one of the those are some of the negative sides of the culture we live in at this moment. The problem with this, the obstacle that we create with this, is that in the way we approach life, we tend to approach our spiritual practice, because the spiritual practice is actually life itself. I remember a teacher once saying that our profession can really affect the way we approach spirituality, because a profession can shape us in a certain way. Let's say you're an architect, so you're very detail-oriented, you calculate things, you look like, you pay attention on how things look. And that gives you, a certain vision of the world. And in that way, you perceive spirituality as well. So this is something it's very important to consider, how we see life and how I am conditioned to see the spiritual practice. So this amount of information and this being a little bit superficial sometimes causes some misinterpretations of teachings. In the past, when there wasn't all this information available, you went to a teacher, and a teacher taught you mainly one particular tradition, and it started from the very beginning into the depths of it. Nowadays, with this, access to several things, it's like this mix and match that can create confusion and misunderstanding. So the practice becomes that. I remember when the Dalai Lama came to Chicago in the last visit in 2011, the whole theme around him was bridging the faith divide. And, there was a great openness about the different traditions, the respect towards them, and each other's path. But at some point, the Dalai Lama told this story about this lady who used to be very Christian. And if I remember correctly, the story goes like this. She felt attracted towards the Buddhist tradition, and she started incorporating some elements from the Buddhist tradition. But of course, these two traditions are so different in some aspects. One of them, for example, believes in the existence of a God, and the other one doesn't. So mixing the both of them, the two of them, could create some great confusion. So the Dalai Lama's advice to her was, stay, with your Christian tradition, become a deeper Christian. To me, that was quite surprising. I would have said, being him, Buddhist, he would have said, that's good, you can, leave your religion and come into the Buddhist tradition. And he said, no, stay with your tradition. And I think that was a very wise advice. I, not being that wise, I would have said, pick one, and stick to it, you know, go into the depth of it. But I'm pretty sure that Dalai Lama has a reason for that too. So in thinking, in preparing the talk, I was pondering, you know, about what kind of tips we can have when it comes to starting a spiritual practice or continuing a spiritual practice. So these tips that came to mind are of course not mine, and there are things that I have gathered throughout the years from different places, but that I have tried to practice at some time and that I have observed in other people and in myself. So I think I could share at least five tips that may be useful for all of us. And even though they can be simple, we can all benefit from them, I believe. So the first tip is that sometimes all we need to do is to stop. Just to stop doing. Stop, considering something, stop thinking about it. Simply stop. Pause. This lady I met, who, she wasn't suffering from any mental condition. She was just, her mind was really agitated and working at a speed that was almost unknown to me. And she was asking me a lot of questions, you know, about the spiritual life and practices and things like that. And her questions went on and on and on, but she was only giving me like 5 seconds to reply to a question. And without me even finishing, she would just bring me another question. And one of the final questions was, how can I balance my chi? Which is, chi sometimes is called prana. It's the vital energy in the body, the energy that circles in the body. And, you know, if it would have been any other person, I would have probably said something completely different. But because she was in this, she was so agitated, I thought, you just need to sit and quiet down and just breathe. And of course, that's not the way you actually handle your chi. I mean, there's a lot of more detail into that. But what I really thought is that the only thing she needed to do was to stop. Just stop. There is a very funny comedy sketch by Bob Newhart. He plays a therapist, and there is this lady who comes see him, the patient comes to see him. And she says, shall I lie down in the couch? And he's like, no, just take a seat here. He says, well, there's only one thing I need to tell you, that I charge $5 for the first 5 minutes, and after that is free. She said, wow, that's a great deal. I'll take it. He said, okay, let's start. What's your problem? What brings you here? And she describes that she feels very confined in small places and this and that. And she basically telling him that she's claustrophobic. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to tell you 2 words, and I need you to pay very close attention to them. And she says, shall I take notes? He says, you can take notes, that's fine. I don't think you're going to forget them, but if you want to take notes, that's fine. He says, okay, are you ready? And she says, yeah. And he says, stop it! And she's shocked. She's like, how stop it? Let me tell you about it. And he's like, no, you just stop it. So then she wants to continue saying, but I was raised in this family in which, and he's like, no, we don't go there. Just stop it. So It's a very interesting, it's a very funny, I think it was quite enlightening. Most of us, at least maybe a few of us, sometimes the only thing we need at times is just to stop. We give a lot of justifications, you know, to ourselves. And the problem, you know, the part of the mind that creates a problem is not the same mind that is going to solve the problem. So if we create a problem at this level, we're not going to solve it at this level. There's something else that needs to happen for that obstacle to be removed. So at the level, you know, in the case of the therapist and the patient, at the level that she wanted to intervene and to continue, that was just going to continue in a circle, you know, again and again. That's just something to consider. Of course, it's just one side of the spectrum and one angle. It doesn't mean that, you know, going to therapy or understanding what's going on is not useful. Of course, it can be very useful. The second tip is something that is mentioned in a lot of disciplines. The first thing that you hear is do no harm. If nothing else, if there's nothing good you can do, at least do no harm. And the harm we can do to ourselves can be you know, different levels. It can be physical, it can be emotional, psychic, mental. At a physical level, you know, we can hurt ourselves, you know, in a hatha yoga class. At a more physical, psychic level, we can hurt ourselves developing certain energies, certain siddhis, certain powers latent in us that are that we don't know how to control, or why they're there, or how they work. Usually, these practices were guided by very wise teachers. So you practice under the strict guidance of a guru, not by yourself, and not just by reading a book or a chapter of a book. So there's a lot of research, there's a lot of meditation involved, there's a lot of understanding and hopefully guidance from a teacher before you do anything that can harm you. There's a number of people come to the Theosophical Society at times with this type of problem, with things they have awakened within themselves and they don't know how to or what to do with them and how to control it. And unfortunately, most of the times there's nothing we can do about it. So it is very important to stay healthy at all levels. There is a subtler type of harm that we can do to ourselves. And, you know, that can be denial. I'm a spiritual person, so I shouldn't, you know, react, or I shouldn't have emotions of this type, or, you know, a complete denial of who we are and where we are. So it's, you know, the acceptance of where we are at this moment and just being, you know, realistic about that. The third tip is to do some good, if possible. And the safest thing we can practice, based in most traditions, is purification. And purification is simply cleaning. We can start cleaning, you know, at a very basic level, we can start cleaning our house. Decluttering, going through the experience of giving away things that we don't need, and living in a clean environment, in an orderly environment that gives, you know, peace to our minds. And then we move into the physical body and we clean the body, we watch what we eat, we try to eat something that helps the body. And, you know, do physical exercise. And we're moving to, you know, the emotions. What type of emotions do I encourage, do I cultivate? What type of relationships do I cultivate? And then we move, you know, into the mind. And again, what kind of thoughts do I allow in my mind? You know, how many negative thoughts I allow to come over and over? Can I cultivate impersonal thoughts, thoughts that are about all of us, about the universe, about the reason why we're here? And, you know, we move into speech. And this is a biggie. What do we say? And why do we say the things we say? How is my speech? Is it, do I talk? What do I say when I talk? Do I only say how good I am at things? Or how bad I am at things? Do I talk unnecessarily? You know, do I talk to feel the emptiness of a moment or the silence? That's a fascinating practice, actually. You find that how do you feel about after gossiping about a person, after making negative remarks about someone? How do you feel about after that? So an observation of how we handle that, and you will see that if you watch it closely, it will come a moment in which you have control of what you say, and it feels really good when you can stay quiet. And good in not in a self-centered way, but a very almost impersonal way. So it's a very peaceful experience just to stay quiet. The fourth tip is simplify. If you want to follow a practice, choose one thing and follow that. If you want to make it, complex, most probably you won't be able to follow up to continue that. And it also, again, can bring some confusion. So pick one thing tonight and practice it for this month. Sometimes, we read a book from cover to cover in a week or in a day, in 2 days, and we get very few. We may get a lot of information out of it, but we actually don't give ourselves the possibility to practice anything from it. So, pick a book, or a teacher, or a practice in particular that you already know, and try to follow that for a certain amount of time. So it's a way of simplifying. And the last one is be realistic. Realistic of your commitment and realistic of human nature. Of the commitment, it can start in a very humble way. I heard of this, this lady whose meditation practice was 5 minutes per day. And I thought that was a joke. I mean, come on, 5 minutes a day? And I'm sure that by now, after 20 years, she's done a lot better than I did, in the sense that it is much better, and it's recommended that you follow a discipline daily, even if it's just 5 minutes. And that's being realistic. That was realistic for her. This is all I can do, and I'll do it for 5 minutes. So, she was able to do it every day. And sometimes when we're not realistic and we want to be perfect and we say, okay, no, I need the 30 minute, the hour, and then we find ourselves most of the times not doing it or doing it very little. So, I think it's a combination of being realistic and being humble too. And realistic of human nature. We came into this world to have an experience, and we all have a personality. And the personality is needed, is necessary to be able to exist at this level, in the physical realm. So that personality comes with certain habits and certain attitudes and things we bring for those of us who believe in past lives or in reincarnation, things we bring from the past. Those of you who don't, just things we bring from, you know, the family and genetics, but we still bring some things. So being realistic about that, that is there, and it will, according to several traditions, that will always be there. Our job is to look at it very closely and become aware of it. So, like a yoga teacher, one of my yoga teachers recently posted something that said, I drink green tea, I burn candles, I meditate, and sometimes I still want to smack some people. And I think that was very healthy to say, and to recognize it, and to, you know, make it part of the process. Of course, you're not going to stay there, but you're going to acknowledge it. So it's part of being, you know, of not denying a part of you. So now a few things that I will keep in mind, and that I try to keep in mind, and I thought sharing them also could be useful. Something that is very obvious that we tend to forget very easily is that we are not the center of the universe. And even though we hear this many times, it doesn't really sink in. That's the way, you know, it's part of the problem of this personality that we have, of the I identity that we have, is perceiving the world from here. And so everything has to do with me. So sometimes, you know, you make this part of your spiritual practice, and you hear people saying, the universe is telling me, you know, to do this. And, you know, I'm not questioning that this person is having an insight about what to do, but sometimes, is it really? I mean, what kind of universe are you? Once I talked to this lady who was also very very active, and she seemed like being a person who needed to calm down, for example. And she said the universe was telling her that she needed to teach. And I thought, I don't know about that. So, sometimes we also use, you know, there's a new trend that I see coming that that is more related to looking for answers, of, you know, into questions that you have, like, what should I do at this moment with this particular situation? And so you go out into nature and you see, you know, a bunny rabbit walking by, and you say, this is the answer, you know, this bunny is, you know, is the answer to my question, and the answer is that I should be free, and I'm just giving an example, right? But, you know, there's a great possibility that this bunny was just walking by, and not necessarily that it has to do with you. You know, I'm not trying to be sarcastic, but these are things that we need to look into. If you talk to a shaman, to a true shaman, you realize that to actually be connected to the spiritual nature of to the animal nature to speak to you, you really need to do a very disciplined practice. So it's not that just because you wish to have an answer is going to come through that. It's that, you know, it involves a lot more than that. So that's what I'm trying to point out at. That, again, we bring this type of superficial type of answers into things that take a lot more than that, a lot more depth than that. This I, this personal nature that we have, can be and is one of the greatest obstacles that we have in any spiritual path, because it gets on the way all the time. It is our main obstacle. It is our impediment to be who we truly are. So it's a biggie. It's a very important thing to look into, to observe, to become aware of. And in this process, we use our personal nature to, for example, desire liberation, or to be able, as I said, to be able to live, to be able to experience, to desire happiness for me and for others. So there is a use of this personality. There is a Hindu sage who said, the personality is the stick with which you move the wood in that is burning into this fire. But eventually, you need to throw the stick into the fire. So I've read in multiple places and, you know, from different paths that it comes to a point in which, as useful as this personality has been, this identity has been for us, we need to drop it. And that's the hardest part of the process, to drop that. So, but if we keep that in mind, if we keep that, that is the ultimate goal, and we can lessen our, you know, self-centeredness, our the strength of our personality of, you know, of needing, we can work towards that gently and slowly. Growing spiritually, and the way I understand it at least, means that we want to get closer to truth, to the truth of things, the way things really are. And truth is not always something we like, something this personality may like or not. Actually, it's defined as something that we may be very scared of. Truth can be scary at times and difficult. In the process of enlightenment, sometimes it is described like how the disciple has to go through different stages of facing certain truths. So it comes to a point in which they have to face, you know, this type of truth, but then, you know, you go further and you face a greater truth. And there is a huge amount of preparation that takes place for that moment to happen and for a disciple to be able to receive that truth. So it's not an easy process. So it's not something that we necessarily like. Sometimes the spiritual path currently is associated with abundance and having everything we want and everything we like. And, you know, not necessarily. It doesn't mean that being spiritual means that we need to be very unhappy. I think all the contrary. If, you know, being part of the spiritual path is cultivating contentment, happiness, and that's crucial. But that's not the reason why we practice. If you remember this, I'm sure that's at least some of you have seen the movie The Matrix. Have you ever? Okay. And so in that movie, the main character is faced with a situation in which he wants to see the truth and the truth of things, how, you know, the universe works and what is going on with all of us. And this person who, you know, seems to know how things work offers him two options. And actually in the you know, this is a metaphor, two pills, the red pill and the blue pill. And so he's in this position of trying to, you know, of choosing between those two things. And if he chooses one of them, he returns to the place where he came from and wakes up from this dream he had, and he forgets everything about what happened. But if he takes the other pill, he is going to be shown the truth. And this person tells him, but remember, the only thing I'm offering is the truth, which means you may not like it. It may not be what you expect it to be. So be ready for that. And I think that applies to us too. Sometimes I find that the problems that we encounter are not related to the practice itself, but to our own limitations. So a person who is awake can learn from a very simple practice, and vice versa. You know, You can go to the greatest teacher in the whole world, but if you are limited, if you are blind, you're not going to be able to understand what the teacher is telling you. So our work is to become more and more awake and lessen the amount of limitations that we have to understand a practice. So this is a more complex subject, but in a simple way, it is basically that it is us at times, and not the practice itself. So, we can learn from a situation, we can learn from life, we can learn from a practice, or we can be completely blind about all of them. It's, in a way, our choice, and many times our very unconscious choice. So there's, not much we can do about it. I think we just need to keep trying and to open our eyes as much as we can. And then motivation. Why do we practice? Why do we follow a spiritual tradition or a spiritual practice? I remember one time I was coming back from a yoga training. I was driving back home, and I was listening to NPR. And I like NPR. I like the stories they tell. I like the way they speak, the English accent. But anyway, I was feeling calm, peaceful, and just listening to that as I drove. And there was this very extremely sad story. By the way, I had become a mom, 6 or 8 months before that. So I had an 8-month-old baby at home. The story was about this place in the world in which parents are selling their children for various reasons, for various sad reasons, slavery, prostitution, and things like that. And I was in shock. I was just shocked. And, so tears started running through my eyes, and I just couldn't believe it. Because even though, you hear certain things, this was just this was an actual person talking about it and giving even numbers of how many people, are doing this. And so for a moment I thought my life was completely irrelevant. I thought, how can I wake up every morning and just go to work or do what I do? Well, in the world, these things are happening. How can we all, as humanity, allow these things to happen and just continue with our own lives as if nothing was happening? How is this possible? I was so upset and so sad, I just couldn't understand at all. And this went on and on for several days. And the question that came to mind over and over was, how can we save them? How can we save them, these children? Some months after that, I was thinking about a genuine spiritual practice. And I was thinking, what constitutes a genuine spiritual practice? And it just dawned to me, even though I had heard this many times before, it was the first time I really, I think, understood at some level. And the reason we practice is to lessen the suffering of humanity. It's just to make this place a better world for all of us. Because the moment we practice, we become more aware of this spiritual nature. And as we are told that, we are all connected and one, this upliftment that comes from one of us can help, uplifting the whole oneness, the whole net, the whole connected net. One of the greatest spiritual teachers, Annie Besant, who was just a wonderful lady, very wise and very knowledgeable, but also very compassionate. She was one of the presidents of the Theosophical Society. She said that, I'm going to just say how she said it, spirituality is the realization of unity, the seeing of the oneness of all things. So combining this, you know, the story that I told with this phrase, I think that we have a clear idea of why we practice and why we are interested in spirituality at all. And taking it from her, you know, she makes it so very simple. Spirituality, you know, it's not about getting this incense or this bench or this yoga mat or, you know, having this or that or this complex practice. She says spirituality is the realization of the one life, but we're one. And the spiritual nature that we talk about is not my spiritual nature. It is ours. It is one thing. And the moment, you know, one of us can, you know, go a little higher, we all go with that. And if we take that in terms of how do we practice, I think it's very clear and very simple. If we, you know, the only thing you take from tonight is that your practice can be that realization, that understanding, the living, not just the intellectual knowledge of that we are one, but the actual living experience of experiencing that we are that one being would be enough for me. So that's pretty much what I had to share tonight. If you have you know, any comments or questions or just points that you were like in agreement or complete disagreement.
What are your feelings about ceremonial magic and the power of evocation to physical manifestation as a genuine spiritual practice?
Can you read that, just the first part?
What are your feelings about ceremonial magic and the power of evocation to physical manifestation?
Okay. There is, as I understand it, there is a very wide variety of ceremonial magic. There is a lot of practices that are called ceremonial magic. So there is some ceremonies that are related to, there are more group ceremonies, and there is individual ceremonial magic. My take on it is that whatever you practice to bring peace, loving kindness, unconditional love to you and others, it's a great thing to do. Now, if your ceremonial magic is to attract, you know, the people you want in your life, all the material things you need, or some harm to others, it's definitely not a spiritual practice. If we go by, you know, what Annie Besant said, spirituality is the recognition that we're one. So would I harm myself? You know, in the sense that, would I harm others? No, I wouldn't. So, I would say if it's, sometimes it's called, if it's white magic, I think it's a spiritual practice.
Hi, Huli, very nice. The other, just a comment you said on when people think they're the center of the universe, the other practice I always like is selfless service because it brings you to that unity and also takes you right out of that ego when you go and serve others. So I always like to add that in.
That's very true. Yeah. Service is a wonderful practice. In the Theosophical tradition, you know, we have a meditation, study, meditation, and service. That's a balanced way of developing or of, you know, of unfolding into a spiritual practice. Study, meditation, and service. And, you know, my brother usually says, how many thoughts throughout the day you dedicate to others? I have very wise brothers.
Is there any risk of just normal, I guess it wouldn't be burnout, but when you repeat a practice for so long, the human aspect of just getting a little bit dull from that practice, is there any tips on avoiding that? Or does that happen even?
I think it does happen. I think it does. I see two things with that. One of them is that, you know, sometimes I teach yoga and hatha yoga. And sometimes you see that after a year, some students get a little bored with some poses. They think they can, you know, they can do other poses instead. And in reality, sometimes you need to repeat the same poses over and over until you can establish a foundation that can move towards other poses. Because if you don't have flexibility in your hamstrings, you cannot, you know, move toward other things. And so part of the process is to stick with the simplicity of things, even if it means to repeat things sometimes. But I can understand, on the other hand, I can understand that sometimes, you know, I've been very fond of a particular type of meditation. And you see that at some point, you get into kind of a circle of dullness. And, you know, sometimes you can stick to it for a while just to notice what comes from it and why do you feel it's this dullness. And why do you think you're bored with it? So I think it's a great opportunity for observation of our motivation and what we're looking for through the practice, what our expectations are. But at the same time, if, for example, we're going through a cycle in which our mind is very active and in need of something else, we can always have a different approach to the practice. So, for example, there's different types of meditations. So you can, you know, for a little while, you can try a different approach and see how to respond to that. Or maybe you just need a little bit of a change. So I think it's just the matter of observation.
I think the last point that you visited when you were talking about the realization of unity, I found especially helpful just now, and kind of had an insight as you were talking, how especially in compassionate people who feel a lot for others and want to do a lot of help for others, if you get to a point where you can't help another person because you can't, they need to help themselves, I think that it's interesting to think that you can meditate and that is still helping them. So I think that helps on many levels in a general sense, but even on an individual basis, I just think that's wonderful. It's a wonderful piece of advice and a great way to practice compassion for in that way.
Yes, I am absolutely. I completely agree with that. And I like the way you put it. You didn't say, you know, sometimes you just didn't say we can help others meditating because, you know, sometimes we take the easy path of saying, well, you know, let them, you know, do their thing and help them meditating. But you said when sometimes you cannot help a person. And that's a very good point. Sometimes, you know, you try, but you just cannot. So we try the silent way to help. And I think that's a wonderful thing. Something I didn't mention is that like we have the gravity, the law of gravity, we also have a law that affects, that returns everything we put out. And if we, you know, whatever we put out there, even if it's invisible for others, but it is visible for that law, it does, you know, become part of that spiritual practice, and it does affect other people as well. So it's not something that we actually need to do visibly to be able to help.
Beautifully said, Huli. Thank you so much for the light you bring to the world. I wonder who wrote that.
My mom. Thank you, Mom. Well, thank you so much, John. That was a very kind introduction. And thank you all for being here tonight. I'm very happy to see you. Not very happy of being on the stage, I must confess, but very happy to see you all. How many of you would say have a spiritual practice or are familiar with a spiritual practice? Okay. Good. So as John said, the talk of tonight was entitled In Search of a Genuine Spiritual Practice. Spiritual practice, sometimes those two words together may sound like a contradiction in terms. Can we really practice being more spiritual? So how does that work? Recently, a friend of mine who lives in California sent me, actually posted a video on my Facebook page, a very funny video. It's actually a parody of those of us who are in a spiritual search or in spiritual practice. And so this person in the video talks about being ultra spiritual and what that means, you know, to be ultra spiritual. And the first advice he gives is practice competitive spirituality. So, of course, it is absurd. So from a certain angle, we can say, what do we mean by spiritual practice? And what I mean in this case is to cultivate certain habits, a certain way of living that may remove the obstacles that don't allow our true nature, our spiritual nature, to shine through. In a way, from a certain point of view, we can say we are already spiritual. So it's not something we need to create. It's something that it is already present there. But we do have to recognize that we still have many times several obstacles to put aside. So it's like a light shining through a little opening, and we make that opening a little bigger and bigger and bigger, and let that light shine stronger and stronger. I like the word genuine because of, you know, it means something that is authentic, something that is honest, something that is real, and that is actually happening. So we're in search of a practice that we're actually going to do. It's not only in our imagination, or it's not only just in our minds. If we take a look at our current society, we're going to see that the world is almost absurdly overloaded with information. Internet is one of the greatest tools that has ever been invented, in my opinion, but has also created a tremendous amount of information available for all of us, which has its positive sides and its negative sides. I recently found out that a blog is being born every half a second. So every second, there is two blogs being created. So count the amount of information that is. Just talking about blogs only. So think about websites and articles and news and books. And also the technology that has allowed, clicking three times and getting a book at home through Amazon, the magic of Amazon. So we have a lot of information available, and that sometimes plays against us, unfortunately. I remember once my brother telling me the story of something he read in an article, the story of this lady who grew up in a very small town that didn't really have a lot of access to information and books. And she grew up with only one book for many, many years. And this book was nature related. So it was, you know, in that topic. But imagine how well she knew that book. How many times she looked into the images. She looked into every corner and every word and really drank all that information and contemplated that so much. Nowadays is quite the opposite. We have sometimes dozens of books at home we haven't even opened yet. And what's worse, this culture of looking into the internet has developed in us this ability to scan very quickly and not go in depth into anything. So it's like a lot of information, but very fragmented. So this way of looking at things, I think, has created a mind that is both sometimes frantic and sometimes dull. Like, I'm sure that you have found yourself like looking into a Facebook page, for example, when you don't have any energy at all, and you just scroll down and look at it, just doing nothing, just, you know, letting the mind get really dull. And at the same time, looking for all this information that makes, you know, your mind get in a certain speed, really fast. And this scanning that has made us a little bit superficial and not, you know, going in depth into anything in particular. So that's one of the, those are some of the negative sides of the culture we live in at this moment. The problem with this, the obstacle that we create with this, is that in the way we approach life, we tend to approach our spiritual practice. Because the spiritual practice is actually life itself. I remember a teacher once saying that our profession can really affect the way we approach spirituality. Because a profession can shape us in a certain way. Let's say, you know, you're an architect. So you're very detail-oriented. You calculate things. You look like, you know, you pay attention on how things look. And that gives you, you know, a certain vision of the world. And in that way, you perceive spirituality as well. So this is something it's very important to consider how we see life and how I am conditioned to see the spiritual practice. So this amount of information and this being a little bit superficial sometimes causes some misinterpretations of teachings. In the past, when there wasn't all this information available, you went to a teacher, and a teacher taught you mainly one particular tradition, and it started from the very beginning into the depths of it. Nowadays, with this, you know, access to several things, it's like this mix and match that can create confusion and misunderstanding. So the practice becomes that. I remember when the Dalai Lama came to Chicago in the last visit in 2011, the whole theme around him was bridging the faith divide. And, you know, there was a great openness about the different traditions, the respect towards them and each other's path. But at some point, the Dalai Lama told this story about this lady who used to be very Christian. And if I remember correctly, the story goes like this. She felt attracted towards the Buddhist tradition. And she started incorporating some elements from the Buddhist tradition, but of course these two traditions are so different in some aspects. You know, one of them, for example, believes in the existence of a god and the other one doesn't. So mixing the both of them, the two of them, could create some great confusion. So the Dalai Lama's advice to her was, stay, you know, with your Christian tradition, you know, become a deeper Christian. To me, that was quite surprising. I would have said, you know, and, you know, being him, Buddhist, he would have said, that's good, you can, you know, leave your religion and come into the Buddhist tradition. And he said, no, stay with your tradition. And I think there is that was a very wise advice. Not being that wise, I would have said, pick one and stay and stick to it. You know, go into the depth of it. But I'm pretty sure that Dalai Lama has a reason for that too. So in thinking, in preparing the talk, I was pondering, you know, about what kind of tips we can have when it comes to starting a spiritual practice or continuing a spiritual practice. So these tips that came to mind are of course not mine, and there are things that I have gathered throughout the years from different places, but that I have tried to practice at some time and that I have observed in other people and in myself. So I think I could share at least five tips that may be useful for all of us. And even though they can be simple, we can all benefit from them, I believe. So the first tip is that sometimes all we need to do is to stop. Just to stop doing. Stop, considering something, stop thinking about it. Simply stop. Pause. This lady I met, who, she wasn't suffering from any mental condition. She was just, her mind was really agitated and working at a speed that was almost unknown to me. And she was asking me a lot of questions, you know, about the spiritual life and practices and things like that. And her questions went on and on and on, but she was only giving me like 5 seconds to reply to a question. And without me even finishing, she would just bring me another question. And one of the final questions was, how can I balance my chi? Which is, chi sometimes is called prana. It's the vital energy in the body, the energy that circles in the body. And, you know, if it would have been any other person, I would have probably said something completely different. But because she was in this, she was so agitated, I thought, you just need to sit and quiet down and just breathe. And of course, that's not the way you actually handle your chi. I mean, there's a lot of more detail into that. But what I really thought is that the only thing she needed to do was to stop. Just stop. There is a very funny comedy sketch by Bob Newhart. He plays a therapist, and there is this lady who comes see him, the patient comes to see him. And she says, shall I lie down in the couch? And he's like, no, just take a seat here. He says, well, there's only one thing I need to tell you, that I charge $5 for the first 5 minutes, and after that is free. She said, wow, that's a great deal. I'll take it. I said, okay, let's start. What's your problem? What brings you here? And she describes that she feels very confined in small places and this and that. And she basically telling him that she's claustrophobic. And he said, okay, well, I'm going to tell you two words, and I need you to pay very close attention to them. And she said, shall I take notes? He says, you can take notes, that's fine. I don't think you're going to forget them, but if you want to take notes, that's fine. He says, okay, are you ready? And she says, yeah. And he says, stop it! And she's shocked. She's like, how stop it? Let me tell you about it. And he's like, no, you just stop it. So then she wants to continue saying, well, but, you know, I was raised in this family in which, and he's like, no, we don't go there. Just stop it. So, it's a very interesting, it's a very funny, I think it was quite enlightening. Most of us, at least maybe a few of us, sometimes the only thing we need at times is just to stop. We give a lot of justifications, you know, to ourselves. And the problem, you know, the part of the mind that creates a problem is not the same mind that is going to solve the problem. So if we create a problem at this level, we're not going to solve it at this level. There's something else that needs to happen for that obstacle to be removed. So at the level, you know, in the case of the therapist and the patient, at the level that she wanted to intervene and to continue, that was just going to continue in a circle, you know, again and again. That's just something to consider. Of course, it's just one side of the spectrum and one angle. It doesn't mean that, you know, going to therapy or understanding what's going on is not useful. Of course, it can be very useful. The second tip is something that is mentioned in a lot of disciplines. The first thing that you hear is do no harm. If nothing else, if there's nothing good you can do, at least do no harm. And the harm we can do to ourselves can be different levels. It can be physical, it can be emotional, psychic, mental. At a physical level, you know, we can hurt ourselves, you know, in a hatha yoga class. At a more physical, psychic level, we can hurt ourselves developing certain energies, certain cities, certain powers latent in us that are that we don't know how to control, or why they're there, or how they work. Usually, these practices were guided by very wise teachers. So you practice under the strict guidance of a guru, not by yourself, and not just by reading a book or a chapter of a book. So there's a lot of research, there's a lot of meditation involved, there's a lot of understanding and hopefully guidance from a teacher before you do anything that can harm you. There's a number of people come to the Theosophical Society at times with this type of problem, with things they have awakened within themselves and they don't know how to or what to do with them and how to control it. And unfortunately, most of the times there's nothing we can do about it. So it is very important to stay healthy at all levels. There's a subtler type of harm that we can do to ourselves. And, you know, that can be denial. I'm a spiritual person, so I shouldn't, you know, react, or I shouldn't have emotions of this type, or, you know, a complete denial of who we are and where we are. So it's, you know, the acceptance of where we are at this moment and just being, you know, realistic about that. The third tip is to do some good, if possible. And the safest thing we can practice based in most traditions is purification. And purification is simply cleaning. We can start cleaning you know, at a very basic level, we can start cleaning our house, decluttering, going through the experience of giving away things that we don't need, and living in a clean environment, in an orderly environment that gives, you know, peace to our minds. And then we move into the physical body and we clean the body. We watch what we eat. We try to eat something that helps the body. And, you know, do physical exercise. And we move into, you know, the emotions. What type of emotions do I encourage, do I cultivate? What type of relationships do I cultivate? And then we move, you know, into the mind. And again, what kind of thoughts do I allow in my mind? You know, how many negative thoughts I allow to come over and over? Can I cultivate impersonal thoughts, thoughts that are about all of us, about the universe, about the reason why we're here? And, you know, we move into speech. And this is a biggie. What do we say? And why do we say the things we say? How is my speech? Is it, do I talk? What do I say when I talk? Do I only say how good I am at things? Or how bad I am at things? Do I talk unnecessarily? You know, do I talk to feel the emptiness of a moment, or